The Bible Study on KFUO Radio is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, centered in the gospel of Jesus Christ in faithfulness, servanthood, responsiveness, and excellence, Concordia Seminary.
Good morning and welcome to the Ask the Pastor program here on listener-supported KFUO Radio. KFUO Radio is a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. I'm Roland Lettner. Thank you for joining us this morning. Thanks again to Pastor Robert Portier. That was a lot of ground to cover, a big portion of chapter 33 and all of chapter 32 in the book of Genesis. Did an excellent job with that. But if you didn't get a chance to get in, well, this is an opportunity for you. You can call in or write in if you didn't get a chance to do so during the last hour. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, KFUO at KFUO.org. Let me appropriately take my little mouse here, click on that. Now the email server is officially running, so we can get your emails as well. Joining us is the Reverend Paul Philip. He serves here at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Remind me what you do for the seminary again.
I serve as the Director of Academic Planning and Assessment, so I work in the Registrar's Office, work on creating the schedule for the students, determining class needs and things like that.
Oh,
and
no one ever takes your name in vain, do they?
Oh, I'm sure not. at least not in front of me.
Well, when you came in, I said, what's new at the seminary? You said, no, same old, same old. I said, well, there's an exciting hour for you. What are we going to talk about?
Well, there actually are some good things going on. We're in the spring quarter. We are in that phase when our concluding students especially are counting days towards the arrival of call day at
That's
the beginning
May.
Of May.
Yeah.
And, of course, commencement about the middle of the month. So getting geared up for that, ready for our students to receive their first assignments or their vicarage placements or internship placements in the not-too-distant future.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Call day, very, very special, very important here on the campus of Concordia Seminary, because everyone tries to park in the KFUO lot, and there's nowhere for the staff to park. So thank
very
you for
true.
Reminding
yes,
me.
Yes.
Hey, I don't know about you, but have you seen the news? My goodness. What would you do with $500 million? Would you as someone who serves in the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, even bother buying a lottery ticket?
You know, I suppose I might bother when a number is of that size. I haven't at this point, but I might bother. What I would do with that volume of money, I'm not really sure. It's a little difficult to begin to wrap one's mind around a jackpot of that size. My thought would be that I probably would have to give it some serious thought and consult people who know a whole lot more about finance than I do to determine what the appropriate way to handle those kinds of funds might be.
I don't know. I might be tempted to buy a small mountaintop somewhere in Germany. And on the sunny side, I would raise grapes, and on the shady side, I would raise goats and live off of wine and cheese the rest of my life.
You know, that wouldn't be an all bad thing, I suppose. And with that kind of money, you probably could buy a mountaintop.
Yeah, you could. Well, I don't know what you could do. You could, you could do a lot of good.
Absolutely.
But probably, wow, how do you think that amount of money, even $1 million, how do you think that might change someone?
I would think it has the capacity to change someone very dramatically and potentially to change someone in a very negative way simply because of, you know, all of a sudden that sum of money comes into someone's life that they aren't accustomed to. They may frivolously use it and do so in ways that aren't healthy for them or helpful to others and could actually really destroy somebody's life unintentionally, but simply because they just don't know what to do with what they might receive and therefore may make some poor choices.
I know what I'd do. It just came to me. I'd buy a congressman.
I'm not sure if that's enough.
Oh, yeah, sadly. Good. You make a very good observation there. Funny statistic, not funny, funny sad, funny ironic statistic, that more than half the people that win a vast sum of money like that, but in that case, this is the largest jackpot ever in the United States, but people that win $1 million, $5 million, $25 million, within 5 years, it's all gone. And they're in poverty.
Mm-hmm. Yes, many times, oddly enough, apparently, these people, or ironically enough, I suppose, end up in poverty and declaring bankruptcy and worse off than they were before. which is almost unfathomable that someone could come into those kind of funds and sort of squander them away. But then on the other hand, one can, I suppose, understand how a sinful nature can take over, and suddenly there you are.
Now, let's play what if. This is fun. This is a fun game. Let's play what if. What if you're a pastor and you have a congregation? Let's say it's a congregation that's okay. You know, it's not troubled, but it's not tremendous. It's doing all right, like a lot of congregations are. And what if one of your members wins that $500 million?
You know, that's kind of a tricky question, because I know there's a lot of folks out there who would be very concerned about that. They're certainly concerned about whether it's appropriate for someone to participate in the lottery or gambling of any type.
Yeah.
Is it right to buy chances at something? And certainly would be concerned about if that individual had any intention of contributing funds in any amount from those winnings, about whether or not it would be appropriate to receive them. There are others for whom that is probably not as large of an issue. I would think that it would be very important in either case to have a very frank and honest discussion with the individual. But it would also be important to, you know, involve the leadership of the congregation and discuss if this person is going to propose making some sort of contribution, how is an appropriate way that they might do that. And how does one also not take advantage of them and sort of assume that they should in that way? So to say exactly what if that happened and I were the guy having to make those decisions, I guess I'd very much want to sit down and have a very serious conversation.
What's 10% of 500 million?
And I think that's what the other jackpot is this week, 50.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a sizable amount, and I think it would you'd have to be very careful about how you approach that.
See, these are questions that I don't know that we really examine, because we don't expect something like this would happen, but to a much lesser degree, don't you think? They really do sort of happen every day when we sort of complain and grouse about this or that in the church or about this or that about the pastor. But then all of a sudden, if you have one person that has the power because of all that money to come along and say, perhaps to the congregation president, you know, if you get rid of this Philip guy, because I don't like the way he preaches, and get us a good pastor, I'll endow this congregation for $10 million.
Yeah, those kinds of situations certainly have the potential to lead to some very serious challenges within a congregation if a person is in that kind of position to be able to throw that sort of sum of money on the table and then attach conditions to it. And I think if you find yourself in that situation, the answer becomes very clear of what the appropriate thing to do is, and that is you don't accept that gift because you're allowing someone to
make decisions.
But it's
$10 million. We could rebuild the school. We could build a bigger parking lot. We could advertise on TV.
True. You have the opportunity to do a lot of things. However, you want to make sure that as you're carrying out the ministry of the congregation, you're doing so in a way that's consistent and appropriate with the Word of God, and to have somebody kind of buying those decisions pretty clearly fall outside of that realm, and thus, as much as it might be nice and even beneficial to an extent to have access to those funds, you'd have to say no, so as not to taint the ministry of the congregation in a way that could be detrimental to the membership.
So how much do you think Dale Meyer would want to name a building after me?
You know, I can't speak for him on that particular point. I really don't know.
But it goes to how we think about things, and sometimes things that can initially be seen as a very positive thing for a congregation. I would think that at first, if the word got out, you know, let's say around my congregation, which is Ascension, you know, on the south side of the city here, that I'd hit that 500. I think a lot of people would have very high expectations of me, and if I chose not to meet those expectations, might feel very hurt, might feel like I've somehow been a bad Christian or less of an honorable person.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's one of the downsides or one of the negative aspects of a person finding themselves in a situation where they've won a sizable amount of money, is not only trying to make the decisions of how to appropriately handle that, but also how to interact with everyone who will have more than their fair share of advice as to how you might handle those funds in relationship to them or some special interest of theirs. And doing, you know, in interacting with them in a way that, you know, engages what your opportunities might be, but at the same time attempting to maintain an appropriate relationship that existed before without damaging friendships, damaging associations, disappointing people who have ideas of what they think you ought to do in that situation. That's certainly one of the, you know, big negatives of somebody finding themselves winning a situation like this, is all of a sudden they have to engage in conversations with people that they're probably not prepared to have.
Well, you know, church being a place where that there is equality, we're all sinners. We declare this every Sunday, I, a poor, miserable sinner. Everybody says this, including the pastor at the same time. A place of forgiveness and restoration, and we're not supposed to judge. Well, we're supposed to judge fruit, but we're not supposed to judge hearts, though hearts tend to get judged more often than fruit, I think.
Right.
Church can be a place that can really hurt some feelings, that can break some hearts.
It absolutely can. And it can create a situation in which you could have an individual very seriously damaged, not only in their personal relationships, but in their faith relationship. If they perceive how others in a congregation treat them as a result of something like this, and it's a negative thing, it could not only cause them to distance themselves from those individuals, but it may cause them to step back from their faith, which certainly is a very dangerous thing and something you don't want to have happen. And so it's important that, you know, we be in tune with that outside of even a context of, you know, someone winning a large sum of money, but just in our interactions within our congregations and within our communities as to how people perceive us, as well as how we're perceived causes them to perceive the church that they may or may not be part of.
Let me play a bit of audio for you here. There's an organization out there called Life Tree Cafe. I'm not very familiar with the organization, but they have started this program of conversations about people who, you know, feel that they have been, have been hurt by the church. You know, awkward things like you give birth to a Down syndrome child, and somehow the pastor comes along and says, "Well, it was because of your sin that you now have to bear this burden." Not exactly the most appropriate words of grace that you as a pastor can express, and they're addressing this. And here's how their little, you know, teaser, the little promo for this program goes. Listen to this.
They come to church for peace, for inspiration, for worship, for forgiveness, for friendship. For many, they find all of that and more. But for some, they leave with something else.
And the pastor came to my house. He sat down at our kitchen table and he said, "Well, I'm sorry to tell you, your father's burning in hell." That was more devastating, I would have to say, than my dad's death. And now you expect me to go on and be a functional human being? My only way to get through that was to get up.
What can we learn from those who've been wounded?
Well, I would think, Paul, that one of these things that we can learn is that being a pastor is not best left to amateurs.
Absolutely true.
And this speaks right to what you do here at the seminary.
Absolutely. In dealing with people, which is a large part of what a pastor does in the course of his ministry. In fact, it's the biggest part is interacting with individuals, interacting with groups of people. And there are certainly, within those interactions, very difficult situations where how one handles them and what one says or doesn't say in those situations can be very important and have a very dramatic effect on the individuals to whom they're attempting to minister. And that's not an easy task. There are many times in the course of pastoral ministry where you have to very rapidly but very astutely make some judgments in your mind of how you're going to handle things. And the way that you're able to do that is by being well-formed, by having, if you will, the tools of ministry that you've been trained in and practiced in throughout your formation at the seminary, and then as you continue in your ministry through just experience and continuing education kinds of things, so that you begin to know how to draw on those things. But at the same time, there are times where, as a pastor, you really don't know how you're going to approach a situation. When I was serving in the parish, I can think of a few situations where, you know, standing outside the door to the ICU or something like that, saying a very short prayer of, you know, Lord, help me to say the right thing here, because I'm not really sure what I'm going to say when I get to the other side of the door. And by God's grace, he provides for his people, and included in that is providing for those whom he's called to serve, his people, the things to say in those contexts. And sometimes the particular passage that happens to come to mind is one you're left scratching your head about as you're on your way back out to your car, and you recognize that God has provided through you at that time. But kind of to the point of the spot that you played there, there is an aspect to pastoral ministry that is extremely difficult when you're working with a situation where perhaps you're dealing a little bit more with the law than the gospel in that particular context, which is certainly part of what we're called to do. You still need to do so in a way that understands and recognizes that you're interacting with another human being who has feelings and emotions, and you can't just kind of lob something out there, a comment like your father's burning in hell is the example that was in the spot there, and just kind of leave it there. You really have to engage that person and help them to process through theologically the circumstances that you're that they're dealing with, and you need to do that with care and concern, and that really does take a lot of skill and a lot of intentionality to do that without placing somebody in a very difficult situation.
So is the law like a hammer, in a sense, where it, in one case it can be used to build, but on the other case it can be used to break?
It certainly can have that aspect to it, where it can be very destructive, and in a certain sense, by its nature, it is going to do that because of our sinful nature. But that doesn't mean that we carelessly wield that hammer. We have to understand how to use it appropriately in conjunction with the other tools that we have, most especially in conjunction with the gospel, so that as we're ministering to an individual, we're doing so in an appropriate pastoral way.
So, if I separate from my wife, get a girlfriend, we show up at church on Sunday morning, and we come to the rail together, perhaps that's not the time to put your hand on my shoulder and go, I'm so sorry about the loss of your relationship. You have bigger fish to fry at that moment.
There's probably a better way to handle that, yes, yes.
So discerning this application of law when it's right, or what, is it ever wrong to apply the law? Is there ever a time when you only apply gospel?
You have to apply gospel appropriately in the sense that it needs to be speaking to something. If there's no law there, the gospel loses a great sense of its meaning because there's no need for it. But at the same time, that law may be present without having to have a lengthy period of time spent articulating it.
So like a dead body in a casket at a funeral, you don't have to say much about the law. There it is.
It's there very plainly displayed in front of the people, and that's a time where you don't have to say too much typically at all, because you're able to transition very quickly to proclaiming the gospel and the resurrection in that context.
But the two are always together in a sense? They're never separated?
They're always together in the sense that there are two aspects of God's Word that speak to each other and come to us, both to us as gift, in such a way that the law demonstrates our need for the gospel, and the gospel then answers that need in a very full and complete way.
Now, speaking about when you apply law, when you apply, all of this is about doctrine, which is teaching. You know, that's one of those big church words, but it really means something very simple, which is you know, just the teaching of the church doctrine. When you want to teach, there are probably appropriate and inappropriate ways to teach. I don't know if you saw this story. Here's the headline. Church under investigation after kidnapping teens at gunpoint during fake raid. Did you see that story?
I did not see that story.
Well, let me tell you, folks that deal with youth, there are good ideas and bad ideas about how to teach your kids about stuff. And here's how the story begins. It says, there's nothing like a fake raid at gunpoint to get one's blood pressure pumping in overdrive. Glad Tidings Assembly of God, a Christian church in Middletown, Pennsylvania, is now catching some attention, and rightly so. It's also catching some heat for this, after staging faked armed assaults to teach teenagers about persecuted Christians and missionaries.
This really does not seem to be an appropriate or even reasonably logical choice to make in terms of how to teach something.
Talking about hurting people in church.
And there's a prime example of that type of thing where, you know, the damage that could and probably was done by that kind of activity would far surpass anything that somebody may have learned out of it.
Here are some details provided in the story. It said that last Wednesday, Glad Tidings Youth Group was kidnapped at gunpoint, hooded, interrogated, herded into a van, and brought to the pastor's home, where the teens were forced to see the faith leader assaulted and covered in what the young girls claim appeared to be blood.
It seems like not only a dangerous way to try to teach a lesson, but one that has the capacity to really not only damage those youth physically, but in a very real way, probably to do some serious psychological damage that may be very difficult to repair and could have some lasting effects on them apart from their faith. Going through that, I don't know at what point they found out that this was a teaching tool and not them actually being, you know, kidnapped and assaulted in a intentional way. But it seems to me that there's more problems there than any potential good.
Do you have kids?
I have a 2-year-old and I have one on the way.
Well, congratulations there. I have a 14, soon to be 15-year-old and an 11-year-old. And if this were done in the youth group to my kids, I would take the youth group leaders and teach them a lesson about angry fathers.
I believe I would be very much with you in that thought.
I don't know if it would go to the extent of hooding and kidnapping anyone, but they would certainly know I wasn't pleased.
Right, right.
But to a serious point, it seems that the church has been remiss, and I speak broadly because there are always these little shining stars of people that do good work in the LCMS and in other places, but broadly speaking, even within the LCMS, there aren't a whole lot of active conversations going on among the laity about the persecuted church. It's not preached about necessarily on Sundays, and other than a brochure or a little blip that you may see in the bulletin, you don't necessarily talk about this very much. This may be an overreaction, but it's an overreaction to what I think these people might defend as being a very serious point that needs to be addressed, and that is, we're kind of fat and happy here in the United States. We think persecution is someone saying you can't say God in a public meeting, but we neglect what real persecution is.
We do. I think we neglect it for a couple of reasons. I think one is, as you say, we're kind of fat and happy here in the United States, and it's somewhat of an out of sight, out of mind kind of thing. So kind of neglect by simply not thinking about. I think the other part of it is we tend to be a bit uncomfortable with recognizing what real persecution is and facing the fact that it is still very much an active part of the lives of many Christians in a large part of the world, and we're kind of reluctant to talk about it because we don't want to think about that potential or think about what that means. But unfortunately, what happens in that is exactly what you say. We lose kind of the concept of what's going on out there and really paying the kind of attention to it that it deserves. I mean, we have brothers and sisters in Christ in other parts of the world who are facing things that we can't even begin to imagine that would make, you know, something like what those youth went through look a little bit more like a picnic than real life. And yeah, we need to make sure that we are praying for and helping those individuals in every way we can.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, KFUO@KFUO.org. Our guest is the Reverend Paul Phillip. He serves here at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. You can call in during the break. It's a great time. When we get back, what would you do to get out of work for a day? We'll be right back. Stick around.
Servanthood is a core value of Concordia Seminary. To be a servant is alien to so many people in our society. Even some clergy take on authoritarian airs. But Jesus, Son of God and Lord of all, came as a servant. We want Concordia graduates to model servanthood to their congregations and to their communities. Servanthood, that's the Christian way.
You gotta love a sirloin. Ounce for ounce, one of the tastiest cuts of all time. It can sizzle in almost any dish, and it always does the little things. Delivering powerful protein and 10 essential nutrients while keeping it lean. On second thought, that's no small task. That's the sirloin. One of 29 lean cuts that make beef one powerful protein. Learn to love them all. Beef, it's what's for dinner.
Brought to you by Missouri's Cattle Farmers. To learn more about lean beef, visit moobeef.org.
Humanitry is dedicated to mothers and children affected by poverty, homelessness, incarceration, and single parenthood. These families need Humanitry, and Humanitry needs you. We'll accept your donated baby clothes, furniture, furnishings, a family project painting a bedroom, or cleaning the yard for a poor working mom. Chaplains can come to your church, celebrate the liturgy, and have Bible study. For these and other ways that you can learn about Humanitry and how we can help others, call 314-772-7720. Thank you, and God bless you.
Woe to the man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had never been born. I tell you the truth, one of you is going to betray me.
East Lutheran Church, 737 Barracks View Road in South County, is having their Living Last Supper based upon the Da Vinci painting. See the apostles come alive and ask, "Is it I? Is it I?" Admission is free, but you must have a ticket. Call the church office at 314-892-5610. Living Last Supper, Peace Lutheran Church, Maundy Thursday at 6 and 8 p.m.
Jets backup quarterback Tim Tebow has survived his first contact with the New York sports media. Tebow said his hope and prayer is that he'll be an asset to the team, and he deflected speculation that he would try to displace Jets starting quarterback Mark Sanchez, saying they've already established a great relationship. When asked about his faith, Tebow said he takes every opportunity to thank his Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, but
in the locker room, it's not something that I'm super outspoken about. It's just that's who I am and that's how I live. And I don't try to share it with a lot of guys. I don't try to approach a lot of guys with it, because I think the greatest way to share the gospel is by acting it and by them seeing who you are as a person.
He seemed amused that his practice of taking a knee and praying after touchdowns has been labeled Tebowing, but said
if people are still somehow talking about prayer or talking about my faith, then I think that's pretty cool.
I'm Steve Coleman.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Here's a fun idea that's going to save lots of unborn babies and spare their mothers the tragedy of abortion. Dave Pomerantz and friends are bringing youthful ideas and great marketing skills to Sidewalk Counseling. Dave was impressed with the mobile ultrasound RV being used in New York City. It parks outside abortion mills with a team to persuade pregnant women not to have an abortion. But Dave's taking it to, shall we say, a higher level. They've designed a smaller ultrasound van beautifully painted with the words, "Save the Storks," and a picture of the bird. It gives a comforting and nostalgic connection to pregnancy. Along with a licensed stenographer, there's support for the mother and the gospel message. It's an abortion mill's worst nightmare, and it'll save lots of babies.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.
Good morning and welcome back to the Ask the Pastor program. The Reverend Paul Phillip, our guest this morning. I'm Roland Lettner. Thanks for joining us. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, KFUO at KFUO.org. Now, I know working for Dale Meyer in the seminary here, it's a joy every day. You probably leap out of bed singing every morning.
Of course. Yeah,
you probably never want to leave. You always just want to stay here and do the good work for the seminary here at the campus of Concordia Seminary St. Louis. But has there ever been a day, and we can be honest here, nobody's listening, has there ever been a day you just didn't want to go to work?
I think we all have days like that. And, the beautiful unseasonably warm and sunny weather that we've been having. There's been plenty of days where you look out the window in the morning and think, you know, there's a lot of places I'd rather be than working. Absolutely. And some days you just don't feel like doing what needs to be done that day.
I have a story for you. I don't know if it speaks to the depth of stupidity of man or the depth of the sinful nature of man or some combination of the two, or maybe even a third option that I haven't even considered yet. But here is the headline for you. It says, desperate, quote-unquote, man saws off foot to avoid work and continue unemployment benefits.
That definitely comes into the category of depth of something. The things that you have noted seem like good choices there. A person would have to be particularly desperate, as the headline states, I think, to even consider cutting off any part of their body. You sometimes hear of a hiker or something who's trapped under a rock, and the only way they're going to get out and survive because they're alone is to do something desperate like this. But to do so to avoid work and to continue to obtain some sort of benefits does seem to be well beyond a sense of normalcy.
The story throws in here that the man lives in Austria, in the district, the province called Styria in Austria. And, it says that desperate that he was going to have to give up his unemployment benefits, he decided this was the way, sadly, the way to go about it. So he literally, not to be too gruesome here, I'll try and be gentle, he causes his foot to be removed from his leg, and then calls the ambulance and tries to claim disability.
It seems like he's certainly gone beyond what would be legitimate for him to receive the benefits he was looking for in either case. You have to believe to be, I guess, somewhat charitable in the spirit of the commandment that there must be more going on in this man's life than what we are aware of here. But this certainly seems to be an unusual way to attempt to get out of doing something that one probably should be doing, which in this case perhaps is looking for a job.
There are other gruesome details. He went to some great lengths to make sure the foot would not be surgically appropriate for reattachment. We won't go into that. But this is what's interesting. This is that sort of Teutonic balance between being overly efficient and still trying to be compassionate at the same time. The fellow who was the unemployment benefit counselor had reported this man on in through the system, up through the ranks, and eventually this comes to Rudolf Hunsdorfer, and Rudolf is the Minister for Social Affairs there in Austria, and as I said, in that typical Teutonic efficiency, he points out that, well, because this was a self-inflicted gruesome act, this man will not qualify for disability. However, this is the compassion side, he can now apply for compensation under mental disability standards.
Well, it seems like perhaps, again, without being too judgmental, that little bit of compassion at the end may point out that there's more going on there than we can recognize.
We do remarkably dumb things, and we reward people for it.
We certainly seem to do so, yes.
You want to live a completely reprobate lifestyle? Guess what? You can show up before Congress and demand your stuff be, your contraceptives be provided at taxpayer expense so that you don't have to alter your reprobate lifestyle.
Yes.
And then heaven forbid someone call that behavior what it actually is, because then you're going to lose all your advertisers.
You could have those kinds of problems.
Oh, gracious, gracious, gracious. Also, down in Tennessee, let me play a little bit of audio here. There's a little bit of a controversy roiling in Tennessee right now. You know, this is a political year, obviously. Not just presidential politics, but all sorts of things are going on. People are proposing changes to state laws. School boards are dealing with changes and all sorts of things going on. Check this out. This has got some interesting stuff in it.
It was a short speech, probably no longer than 5 minutes.
I'm asking him to bless this event with safety and good sportsmanship, federal case.
But for Jody McLeod,
nevertheless, as a school principal, I frequently...
It was all he needed to say.
If you read the speech carefully, what you'll see is it is a request for tolerance.
He questioned aloud to a football crowd why it was acceptable to speak about things like abortion or safe sex, but not prayer in a public setting.
I was somewhat frustrated by the very fact that it had become an issue.
This all came after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional for students and staff to pray over a school's PA system. McLeod said he never forced students to do such a thing, but he felt it was their right to pray if they wanted to.
Keeping them away from PA system to say a 45-second prayer just did not seem reasonable.
After he delivered his speech, its popularity grew. Tennessee gubernatorial candidate Zach Womp met with McLeod. Congressman John Duncan read his speech in Washington. Many others passed it around via email.
It was about 2 or 3 years later after he had actually made the speech.
The positive support was no surprise in Kingston, a place where steeples line the streets.
Me, it just reinforces and it brings things back to what it should be.
But not everyone feels this way. The ACLU recently said in response to new legislation, quote, "We like to recognize that public schools are not Sunday schools." And that's something McLeod understands. But he feels everyone should have the right to express whatever they want. Even here, in Kingston.
You do not, in any sense, ever make your flame brighter by putting someone else's out.
Well, now that was an interesting closing comment.
It is.
Yeah. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Phone lines are open for your questions and comments. So what do you make of this? Here's a little bit that the news story with that report goes along with it. It says, local school boards, if this legislation were to be passed, that's being proposed in Tennessee, local school boards would be required to select students voluntarily to express their religious viewpoints, be they Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Wiccan, atheist, and they would be able to do so at football games, school assemblies, graduation ceremonies, and so on. And it's called the Religious Viewpoint Anti-Discrimination Act.
You know, one of the challenges that comes when we enter into the discussion of something like prayer in schools is how does a school that is a public entity deal with not only if you're going to allow something like that, but the list that was in the article there about the various religious affiliations that would be included. And one of the, I think, dangers is that while I certainly support the opportunity for Christians to be able to exercise their faith in the public square and encourage it, and certainly want students in school to be able to pray, I also would rather not have those same Christians needing to sit through a long series of prayers to all kinds of false gods and from the perspective of all kinds of false religions. So you kind of have an awkward balance there, and in some senses, it can be a real challenge.
I wonder if this shows a little bit of naivete on the part of people who are Christians who always try and ascribe good motives. Even earlier in this conversation, you talked about putting best construction on something. But what if they select voluntarily, someone volunteers who happens to be a Muslim, and the prayer they offer up is something to the effect of, "O Allah, in your wisdom, you have commanded us to smite the infidel."
Right. I mean, you have to think through, you know, what potential could come, and if you think through the kinds of things that are in the backgrounds of some of these religious belief systems and in some of the extreme portions of them, the kinds of things that could happen could not only cause a lot of discomfort in the setting, but could really lead to some serious problems within the context of that school or that community.
The principal does make a good observation about you don't amplify your light by trying to snuff out someone else's, but is this the appropriate way to amplify that Christian light?
You know, it seems like this might not be the most appropriate way to do that. You know, sometimes you could have opportunities where groups of students could get together or something like that, but to have it be a major public display may not be the best way to do so. And there may be other ways, simpler and even more efficient ways, to kind of share that light. One of the things that comes to mind with a story like this is what seems to be kind of an annual discussion around Christmas time about where there should or shouldn't be displays of the nativity. And I've often thought if all those individuals who spend inordinate amounts of time and funds on fighting to have the nativity in front of City Hall would use that same energy and funds to create or purchase nativities for their homes and their congregations and places where they wouldn't need to go through a large rigmarole to have it, we'd probably have a broader proclamation of Christ than by going out and having a major a fight about it.
First Amendment to the United States Constitution says Congress shall make no law. And they define that down, at least in the good old days, they used to define that down then to the states and then to the counties and then to the local communities. And if with community acclamation, the city fathers wanted to put a nativity scene on the front lawn, that was that community's right. But now the federal government, and this is going right back to President Harrison going before Congress and testifying about the Health and Human Services mandate, it's not the location of the creche, it's not the prayer that maybe students want to do voluntarily themselves, it's the fact that the government gets involved and now starts to say, this is right, that is wrong, this is when, not then.
Right, and that's where we get into a very serious problem of all of a sudden we do have a government entity at whatever level it might happen to be dictating what churches and the members of those churches in terms of what they believe can and can't do and starting to give preference to one belief system over another. And now we're getting into a very serious problem. And there's a reason the First Amendment is there. And part of that has to do with the context that the Founding Fathers came out of, which included, among a lot of other things, similar kinds of issues.
Yeah. So, for example, if a city government wants to open their local town meeting with a prayer, and by majority, the people say that that's all right. If somebody stands up and voices an objection, they should have the right to voice the objection. But ultimately, in this republic of ours, democratically based, if that's the affirmation of the people, respectfully done.
Sure.
Should there be a problem with that?
There could be.
Yeah.
And you know, the difficulty is that on the one hand, yes, they could elect to do so, and democratically so. The challenge would be in the context where them electing to do so then necessitates this series of everybody else being able to do the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's where it can be a serious problem.
When you look, I am not one who is in favor of driving Christ from the public square. I think Christians need to be present there to both express the law and the gospel and to live out our sanctification by serving our neighbor in that respect. But I really wonder if when the government steps in and decides what types of expression of, I mean, when you consider that your money, your dollars, say, in God we trust,
right,
and those dollars then go to pay for pornography and drugs and that sort of thing, is that really the best way to use God's name, by putting it on the currency?
You know, it probably is not. When funds are being used for those kinds of things, you have a very serious problem there.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, KFUO at KFUO.org. You know, there never seem to be simple answers. But see, that's why I think sometimes Lutherans get looked at sort of funny, because we're not known as strong advocates for school prayer. Because we're aware of the fact, like you were discussing, that the Muslim, the Jehovah's Witness, the Mormon will then have equal right to stand up and pray before your children and proselytize them.
Right. And I think, one of the things that sets us apart in that sense is that recognition. It's not to say that we don't, however, support our children to be able to pray in school.
Absolutely.
What we do want to support is that opportunity for them to do so individually. But also, we very much recognize the importance of that being a corporate part of our students' daily lives, which, of course, is why we have the Lutheran school system that we have, to provide a location where they're absolutely able to do so and express their faith very clearly without having to engage with all of those series of other challenges that might come with it.
Yeah, it's not as easy as it appears to be on the surface sometimes. There's This you mentioned time of year Christmas just a moment ago. Well, this is time of year Easter.
Right.
And, well, you know, fasten your seatbelts because between now and Sunday of next week, Easter Sunday, History Channel, Discovery Channel, Learning Channel, all those channels are going to be, you know, the real Jesus, the real Judas. What does the Bible really say? Did he really rise from the dead? What was, you know, you'll find folks like the Jesus Seminar or John Dominic Crossan, who's sort of that innocuous little Irishman who says, the body was torn down and fed to dogs. Don't worry. It was a spiritual resurrection. Believe it or don't. It doesn't matter anything in the world. All these things are coming up. So it should be no shock that here comes a story that says in the headline, Shroud of Turin moved apostles to believe Christ's resurrection.
It shouldn't be a shock. It fits right in with that series that we typically find around this time of the year. I'm not sure how a piece of cloth can move anyone to belief in anything in particular. It's hard to understand how something like what the title of the article says there would be the case.
Well, set aside Scripture, because we know today that Scripture has no value whatsoever when it comes
sure.
to these sorts of things. We have to rely on science. It says here that there's a new book out that purports that it was this very artifact that caused Christ's apostles to believe that he rose from the... Never mind Thomas. Never mind the upper room. Never mind appearing to all those other people. Never mind broiling fish on the Sea of Galilee. No. It was this particular artifact, as they call it, that does this. And it says, that, now the book is called The Sign, The Shroud of Turin, and The Secret of the Resurrection. Everything's a secret today. Have you noticed that?
Oh, yeah, everything's a
all
secret.
All this neo-theology, it's all about the secret.
Right.
Secret of this. Thomas D. Wesselow is the fellow's name. He works out of King's College in England, and he says all of the contents and methodology of the book is set to, all this is set to be released soon. Matter of fact, just a couple of days before Easter, it's surprise, surprise, set to be released. This has mostly been kept a secret by the church.
Well, like you say, if you're going to set aside all of what Scripture has to tell us and so forth, I would imagine that you can probably write a book that makes an argument that this particular artifact in some way was at the root of or responsible for to an extent in bringing about a faith in someone. I'm not sure how you really would be able to demonstrate that, or how you would be able to substantiate that kind of a claim. But I could see how somebody could could go down that road with something like the Shroud of Turin and try to do so.
Well, it's only a matter of time before the theory is put out there that he was just being transported back to the Enterprise, and it was that caused the shroud to be, gracious. Let's go to the phones here. Hey, look at this. You got a brother pastor on the phone here. Our good friend, Pastor Tom Hendrick, is joining us. How you doing, my friend?
Hey, I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I am better than I should be.
Well, but not as good as you will be.
I hope so.
Okay. This is a very intriguing discussion, and especially when we start talking about what's on our money and God we trust, or when we pledge allegiance to the flag, one nation under God, indivisible. And it always raises in my mind the question, who's defining God? What God is it? And I, quite frankly, and this is going to knock a lot of people off the chairs, I have a hard time uttering the words in the Pledge of Allegiance to the Flag, one nation under God. Because if I'm standing next to a Muslim or next to a Buddhist, they're thinking their God, I'm thinking my God. So now we have a civil religion at work, which Dr. Abrams has written about quite a bit. I think we really need to rethink this whole thing about confessing God on our money or in our Pledge of Allegiance, unless or until we define him as the one true God of the Bible, who's the person and work of Jesus Christ defines it.
I think that's a good point, because you have that kind of a problem. If you're using the term God in a generic sense so that anybody who's using it or reading it can kind of define in their own mind what they're thinking of or who they're thinking of, then yeah, you have a very serious problem, because you have allowed the one true God to be distorted into whatever anybody happens to want to make of it. And I think that makes somewhat of a strong argument towards we either need to be clearer about what we're talking about, or maybe we do need to take that name off of a context like our money, or out of the pledge.
See, Pastor Hendrick, I think there's an important distinction to be made here about your comments. What you were doing is you were making a positive argument for a purpose of discerning when it's right for the government to step into faith and declare faith, whether it be on the money or in the pledge or however else. But then there's the other side of your argument, which is the negative side, which is God has no place anywhere in the world. There is no God. You're stupid for believing him, and we got to eradicate him from any expression anywhere.
Yeah, and certainly I'm not, as you well know, I'm not supporting or espousing that. But my concern is what you said. Government should not be the one to define God. The church defines God. And like even right now, I'm about to go into a Rotary meeting, and we start the Rotary meetings with prayer and with the Pledge of Allegiance. If we were to say, okay, in this context, we understand and we agree that God is the God of the Holy Scriptures defined by Jesus Christ, I would have no problem uttering the words, one nation under God. But we don't. And we have people in there that are not necessarily Christians. Therefore, I cannot, in good conscience, utter the words, one nation under God, indivisible, alongside the rest of my fellow club members.
Thank you, Pastor. Safe travels.
Hey, thank you. Have a good day. God bless you.
You as well, my friend. Yeah, good observation, I think.
It is. And there's an issue there that he's getting at that does make a point that we need to think about when we're uttering those same words, that we kind of understand what we mean and what context we're uttering them in, and what those around us may be thinking.
Yeah. Reflect on the words of Pilate. Especially, we're going to hear this very soon as we go through Passion Week, the Passion Week narrative, the words of Pilate. What is truth?
Right. And we need to be very clear and articulate about what truth is and what it isn't.
There is one God, there is one Christ, and I think Pastor Hendrick was right. The church defines. Well, I don't know the church defines. The church exposes true Christ.
Right, yeah. It's not we who have been given to define who God is. He's defined himself for us.
Exactly.
In the incarnation.
See, how easy it is to
son.
Slip into this? You don't even think about it. You just go, yeah, the church defines. Yeah, right. That is true,
right.
But the church exposes and teaches and preaches who the Christ is.
Right.
Boy, welcome to Holy Week. Stuff to think about.
Absolutely.
See, I thought it was easy. I thought it was all about bunnies and Easter eggs and stuff. You make life so complicated, don't you? But, be careful. Be on guard, because a number of these programs are going to be coming up. Here's another one that relates to the Shroud of Turin. We've got about a minute left. Oh, we got a phone caller. I don't know if I have a chance to get to you. We'll see if we can squeeze you in real quick. It says, latest Shroud theory, Christ's resurrection... Are you ready for it? I wish we should have a drum roll sound effect here. Was an optical illusion.
An optical illusion.
That's right. It was David Blaine. Mirrors. Woo.
Well, again, not a surprising comment to hear around this time of the year, but if merely an illusion, then we certainly have serious problems. But it's quite clear that it's far more than anything elusive.
Jim, I'll give you 20 seconds. Jim, you still...
Hello?
Yeah, you got 20 seconds.
Yeah.
Hurry. Time is fleeting.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, I have to disagree with the pastor who called in about In God We Trust on Our Money and One Nation Under God. Who is the church? The church is the people of God. And as a Christian, when I say that, I know who I'm praying to and whom I'm speaking of. And if we take that, allow that to be taken out, if someone else is praying to another God, well, we know that the Almighty God will deal with them.
All right, Jim, thank you for the call. We do have to scoot along. The clock is an evil taskmaster, and it shall be adhered to. We'll continue this on tomorrow. Reverend Paul Felt, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Listen Monday through Friday at this same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download programs from the Bible Study archives at kfuo.org. The Bible Study is underwritten by Concordia Seminary, St. Louis.